Greetings, nerds. This is Cena Nerd. I'm your host, Sarah Belmont, and with me, as always, is our Mr. Producer, Will Falk. How are you doing tonight, Will?
Doing very well, Sarah. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing good.
That's good. Know? Yeah, new, different night recording, Wednesday evening. Happy hump day.
Yeah, I wanted to record because tomorrow and Friday I have off work.
For you.
And it just feels good to like not have to be like, oh man, I can't do that because I gotta record. I mean, I love recording with you on a weekly basis, but it just felt better.
No, sometimes, as we were just talking in the pre-show, you gotta do things for self-care, make sure you take care of yourself. So it's very important. So I'm glad you're getting a little bit of downtime.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it just because I'm so curious of why you don't want to talk about the Deadpool and Wolverine trailer, because I kind of watched it. And when I say that, it means after you told me that you watched it, I randomly threw on Kind of Funny's reaction to it.
Okay.
And so I heard a lot. I really wasn't paying attention, though, because I don't want to. I don't want to have the trailer cloud my judgment of the movie.
Yeah.
But I was curious because you sent me a message and said they're trying too hard with all the F-bombs. Yeah. And so my ears were peaked. I'm like, I want to hear all of this cursing. And I will be honest, because of that, I was like, I heard a little. I didn't hear too much, but maybe I watched the wrong version.
No. It was more of a commentary on just the tone. More so than the number. I mean, the number of fucks, I mean, I think it wasn't so much that. It was just more the tone of it. I mean, don't get me wrong. I liked the trailer. I enjoyed it. And I did. Oh, the other part I did say was I was part glad I watched it, because it's the bit with the cocaine at the end. I mean, that I was laughing out loud. But then on the other hand, I was mad at myself for watching it, because then I'm like, did I get
the funniest bit?
All the funniest bits? Exactly. So I'm like, do I go to the theater now? And it's sort of like, I already saw that in the trailer. I mean, I'm sure there'll be tons of other things. But, you know, it's that eternal struggle that you and I, we've talked about many years around the podcast now, and especially Marvel trailers in particular. Yeah. Do they give too much away? And so that's where I was sort of like, before we started recording tonight, I posed a question to you. Did you watch it? One. And two, do you want to talk about it? Because, if you're listening to us, if you're thinking you're going to get all the, like, Cassandra Nova and all those little details and that kind of stuff, we're not your podcast. No. Go listen to somebody else. We're folks who just like you, who just love talking about these things and fun and know a little bit of the lore, maybe not so much on other things, but
just
put it out there.
Yeah. I see the tone that I observed aligns itself with the previous two movies. And we have also talked about our feelings about those two movies. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. We'll see, because there are sometimes when, they really do put the funniest bits in the movies, in the trailers, and then you watch the movie, and sometimes you're like, oh, I already saw that, and then sometimes you're like, even with it in context now, it's even more funny.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why
you can never tell.
Yeah.
It's so hard.
And that's why I have feelings,
It's just a matter of, once you're in that theater watching it on the big screen and there are other people around you, like, what will that environment and how will the movie, like, just speak for itself? I let's put the trailer aside. They continue to do such clever marketing. The whole new poster that's an allusion to the Logan poster. I'm just like, come on.
Yep.
I just like the posters. God, and we never talk about posters because I'm like, who cares? But this is just genius concepts. So
yeah,
very, very cool. So on that note, another good reason why we moved it to tonight is because Shogun dropped its final episode, episode 10, A Dream of a Dream, last night. And we have both watched it. And so now we get to wrap up this, our talk on Shogun season one. And the IMDb summary says for this episode, in the wake of a tragic death, Blackthorne finally considers the true nature of Toranaga's plan. Will, what are your overall thoughts as such a Shogun fanboy?
Yes, I am a Shogun fanboy. Overall thoughts, I found it to be a very satisfying finale. You know, no surprise there.
Yeah.
But I will say, in complete transparency here, as I was watching the episode, there were some moments where I was wondering where they were going to go. And there were a few moments where I was feeling like some feelings of anticlimactic started to resonate in me.
Yeah.
But then they brought it home. And then I was like, yeah, this is how you close out a series. And I was very satisfied. But I had the theme song on a loop.
You would. Yeah. I feel about this episode the way I feel about this entire season of Shogun. I should like this show more than I actually do. At the end of the day, there is nothing wrong with this. Is it anticlimactic? Absolutely. But does it make sense in context of the story that we've been given? Absolutely. Everything makes sense to an extent. Yeah. But at the same time, I think it really is kind of like, to your point, it's anticlimactic just because it's much more like a prologue as opposed to an actual conclusion, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fine, and I'm used to. I mean, go back to Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones has a lot of, like, their penultimate episodes are better than their finales.
Yeah.
So I totally understand that. It's just that overall, this show, I respect it. There is nothing wrong with it, but I'm also not in love with it.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's because of, I'm not in love with all of the characters. I'm in love with maybe a handful. Mm-hmm. So you brought up some spots where you thought that, like, where you were really feeling the anti-class or where they're going to go. Do you want to start with one of those?
The very beginning with Blackthorne lying there on his deathbed. Because I was like, and one thing about this episode, these episodes all overall, is the titles have really done a good job of sort of capturing the spirit and the theme of the episode very, very well. Sometimes, you know, the titles are just titles. People don't pay attention to them, but they really did a dream of a dream. This, because it was one of those things where I was just like, huh. Where are we going to get, you know, when they talked about, you know, whenever the kids, grandkids asked, like, did you get that from the savages? And I think made a comment about the dent, maybe a chip in the sword or something like that. And then as the show started to progress, I guess it kind of set me up wanting to see where that was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so of course, later down, you know, as we get further in episode, and as we'll talk later this evening, we realize that we weren't looking at the future. There was actually Blackthorne, present day Blackthorne, in the story was like imagining how things were going to turn out for himself. But you know, but I thought they really did a good job of, like, to, at least for me, it created an expectation of what that at that time, as I was watching it real time, thought it was a flashback. Looking for that place, it didn't come the way I thought it was going to. So that's where it kind of, where I was like, where are they going with this? But as I said, other things in the story really fleshed out that opening scene better and really explained what was actually going on there. That after everything transpired, then with getting to Fiji and Blackthorn on the lake. And we see that the Mariko's crucifix is there with them, that I was like, ah, that's what they were doing there, and that's where I was like, yeah, I'm satisfied. That I love that whole sequence there with him and Fiji.
So they were dumping her remains as well?
The cross. Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, because
I'm confused because I know that they dumped her family. Her son and husband's.
Right. And then they took out Blackthorn, took out Mariko's cross.
Right.
And then Fuji was like, you should be the last, you should hold her last. And he dropped it into the water.
Okay. Okay. I don't know. I think I blinked. When he dropped it.
Well, and they dropped it. They show it like sinking into the ocean.
I was like, oh, I don't have to read anymore, so let me look at my phone. That's what happened there. Like this is another reason why I'm not sold on this show is because I was never invested in Mariko Blackthorn like as a couple. Mm.
You were more Mariko and Father Abito.
No. I don't understand me. I found Bentaro to be a more fascinating character because of the choices that they made with him. Not necessarily. I wasn't saying
I'm just joking with you for throwing a line you had last week.
In a very harmful way. So just let me be clear. I was never like a fan of them being married or together. I just think that people villainized him more than they actually should have based on the things that were done. I mean, anyways.
I know, and if you folks should go back and listen to our discussion on that, because we went for quite a bit on how Sarah felt he was being overly dumped on when I pretty much dumped on him pretty hard, I guess.
Yes, because Will played right into what the writers want you to do. I'm like, no, I don't care what you want me to do. I don't understand.
But I was thinking, I think this is a good segue to talk about Mariko and her the deal that she made with mm-hmm. Father Alibido.
Because she didn't just make that deal. Tornaga made it too.
Yeah, but she spared Blackthorn's life. That was
more, and Tornaga.
And Tornaga. Both of them did, with the ship and how, and they sold that very, very well, in my opinion, especially with the Christian Raiders and seeing like the decapitated heads there on the spikes and Anjuro, the village.
It was for both the viewers and the characters themselves. It was a very good
distraction.
I don't know if it was a distraction so much as trying to get you to think one thing when really the other is going on.
With Mariko's death, the fallout from it, as far as Yabushige, his guilt. He had his Lady Macbeth moment.
He had a lot of weird moments. Yeah. I mean, it was his guilt. Insanity almost him being hit. I mean, let's take it back to the first time or how we're introduced to him. He has an obsession with death.
And
we see him throughout the season kind of circle it. And then in this episode, witnessing Mariko sacrifice herself, knowing he's the cause of it. This is the one time where his character kind of I don't know, kind of like wasn't as, I think it got a little muddled on his character, because I still don't quite understand how he ended up in there with them. I still don't know. No, I understand that.
Yeah.
But then, like, did he go back to his quarters? I mean,
no. So as the fighting was progressing, whenever he let the ninjas in, forerunners of the ninjas in, he was trying to, like, play, you know, his job is Shugay. So, yeah, I let these people in, but then he started to, like, pretend like he was trying to defend Mariko and Blackthorn and all the rest of them, and they all ended up getting, you know, caught in that room. So that's how he ended up in there, because he was just being his usual duplicitous self.
Yeah. Yeah. Survivalist. That's the word.
Yeah.
And so he has some shell shock, I think, from all of that. That leads to him just being more messy. And Ishido lets him go back. But Toranaga, like, both of these guys who he's been, like, trying to play both sides with, ends up disowning him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Toranaga demands that he kills himself. So commits seppuku. And I find it, as anticlimactic as it was, my favorite character on the show finally gets let in on the plan. And as one Toranaga tells to, and he, like, suddenly he's our avatar to understanding, like, we're not going to see the quote unquote battle that didn't shed any blood. No. We're just going to hear about it. And the story is going to conclude. So the overarching story of Toranaga's battle with Ishido comes to a head, and we get the whole plan unveiled to Yabushige right before he kills himself. And it's just like, that's again why he stuck out to me, is because even at the end, like, he finally gives us the answers we've been looking for.
Yeah. Yep.
Only to die, which he's wanted to for so long.
Yeah. And his, I mean, everything about Yabushige, he was true to himself to the end, even with his death plans, like, feed me to the dogs.
Yep. Feed me to the dogs. They're hungry. And yeah. I don't know. It's very interesting. And that's, again, why I have a lot of respect for the writing of this show, is because the whole cultural perspective and also individual perspective on life and death that's played throughout the entire season. And really, this whole episode, like it's much more philosophical about life and death, as we see even Blackthorn attempt to commit seppuku this episode, but Toranaga denies him, and just because Blackthorn makes him laugh.
Well, but Blackthorn makes him laugh. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's not the grandest thing. It's just like, you know.
It makes him laugh. And maybe he can help build a Japanese Navy. I don't know. I don't know. He's apparently picking up on Japanese real quickly. So they don't need a translator no more.
But of course they don't need a formal translator, but we do learn that Murage, you know, Mitsuko. We learn more about him as far as the fact that he, you know, he speaks Portuguese just like Blackthorn, and Toranaga had dispatched him to be a spy, but he became so and so embedded that he actually ended up adopting the faith, you know. So, but I really liked how they closed the loop on that character. I mean, that was speaking of the writing. I mean, that's another thing I think they did a really solid job, and why I found this finale stuck the landing for me. Even though, as I said earlier, there were some points where part of the anticlimax too was just. I mean, we know that Torunaga becomes the Shogun.
Right.
But the point of what I was going with the writing is they really did tie up all the loose ends with these characters. I mean, I don't feel like I'm, at least with this aspect of the story, I know where everything lands with these characters. Now, if they hypothetically, which probably won't happen, but if they wanted to do another season and show how, you know, showed a battle and how Torunaga's first few years of a shogunate is run, then, you know, they could do that. But to me, that would diminish what they've established here if they did something like that for the cash grab.
Why did Ochiba decide to bail on Ishido?
It was the meeting with Mariko. Because she, you know, when it had the poem, that moment in last week's episode, the seeds were planted there, whenever they had their moment there in the garden. And then we saw it sort of play out after, I think, Ishiba figured, I think there's several things. I think one, she saw what Ishido was up to. Just basically leading the country to a pointless war with Torunaga. One of the factors. Two, I think she saw that his fingerprints were all over Mariko's death as well. So I think between all that, and then, you know, she's talking to her son, the future Taiko, you know, she helps him, you know, they have that very poignant conversation, and she finishes out the poem that Mariko was trying to tell her when her son was writing that poetry. So I think all those factors, among others, and I'm sure the listeners will, you know, feel free to, you know, comment on our pages and stuff about what, you know, other motivations, but those are some of the ones that I think top of head that come to mind.
Yeah, I don't buy it. There's something still. I understand what you're saying, and there has been seeds planted far earlier. I remember at the play, the Taika's wife mentioned she chose the wrong side. But at the same time, the Ochiba that we're introduced to, and more importantly, her hatred of Torunaga, like, they committed so hard with that as an introduction to this character that it just seemed weird to me. Mm. It seemed a bit off. And we talked last week about my feelings about that interaction between Ochiba and Mariko, where it didn't really seem completely in character for me. With how Ochiba responded. So that's probably also why her suddenly deciding to take Torunaga's side didn't really align, where I feel like they focused more in the later half of the season, and rightfully so, on the motivations of Torunaga, Mariko, Blackthorn, a little bit of Yabushige. And less on Ishido and Ochiba, where once you lose like that threat and that villainous like motivation, things get a bit muddy for me of being like, okay, so.
See, yeah, I disagree with that some. I mean, I think, because I mean.
Well, I know you do.
Yeah, because, well, I'm just going to, where I disagree is they still focused on it with, unless you're. Let me just ask you this for clarification. Are you saying that, you know, the things. Was that sort of resolved for you once he did all his, Ishido did all the scheming to build, you know, to get the five members of the Regents to be able to impeach Torunaga? And then from that point forward, you're like,
I don't know. I just, they didn't feel very much like a threat because Mariko already, like, I don't know. It just, yeah, they didn't feel like a threat.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's fine. I mean, yeah, I mean, I agree with you that the narrative shift did focus more to the to Mariko, Blackthorn, and Torunaga. I mean, there's no doubt that it did. I just didn't know if you had any other thoughts as far as the threat lesson, other than, you know.
They lost the political game last episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, they also, but they also, I don't know. It just, there wasn't enough time there where this, I feel like, I don't know if it's like, I don't know if it's that they, I feel like they're much less of a threat. It's just that their motivations for their actions weren't clear for me.
Okay.
Like, okay. From for the first half, it was very clear to me what the political moves were. And then once we understood why Ochiba was siding with Ichido, her decisions were clear to me. Okay. But the later half of the season, it's kind of like as soon as Mariko entered the court, suddenly they were stupid. Mm. And suddenly they didn't, I don't know, especially Ochiba, because she like, I get your point. She saw him leading the country to a pointless war, but at the same time, that's the war she wanted. So yeah. I don't understand. Like, she helped him, like, feel this. This wasn't an Ishido only thing. He needed her in order for, like, this to really come to head. And then she gets cold feet. Like, I don't know. They spent a lot of time in this episode focused on making sure we understood all of the good guys' maneuvers and plots to secure victory. Mm-hmm. And again, this is all rightfully so. I find it very thin what they did in terms of their quote-unquote villains. We hardly got any screen time with them. And then suddenly, next thing you know, we get a letter. And then that letter says this. And you're just like, okay. But then again, at the beginning, we talked about how this episode is very much like a prologue and not a finale, like a spectacular finale. I mean, the Crimson Sky, to Torunaga's point, that occurred last episode. That's not this episode. This episode is more of like the aftermath and people realizing, like, okay, now under this new rule, where is my place? And Blackthorn accepting that he's never going to leave Japan, mm-hmm. in a way.
yeah. No, I think that's why I like this final so much. Because it did kind of subvert, like, you know, because we did have all this build up, like, it's going to be a big war. And we're also conditioned in a lot of ways to, like, in other shows and properties, like, we're going to have this big, massive third act fight, and, you know, and this is going to happen. But here it was really, like you said, I mean, and Torunaga said it himself, you know, the Crimson Sky was Mariko. And, you know, he sent a woman to do what an army couldn't do.
Okay. Anything else you want to say about A Dream of a Dream?
Yeah, just the last point, and one thing that I know we kicked about throughout the season, and just wanted to get your thoughts on it, especially with Torunaga and Yabushige's unveiling of the plans right there before his Yabushige's demise. So do you think at the end of the day, Torunaga wanted to be the shogun or for personal gain, or he was doing it for the good of the country? Did he want the shogun? Because all throughout, he was like, you know, and we talked about this before, he said he was trying, his goal was to follow the Taika plan, which was, you know, his son comes of age and then he takes over. But
yeah, I think he wanted to be shogun. Isn't there a line in this episode that Ishido or somebody says while they're in Osaka that the earthquake, an earthquake occurred right before the Taika was going to go to war with Toranaga.
Right when the council was having their discussions, they had the earthquake.
I
thought that was a bit on the nose.
I absolutely agree. Yeah. Whether or not, I'm just going to say this. The absurdity that people would make a claim that, he's just going to be the most powerful person in the country for the good of the country. what? I don't. 1 + 1 does not equal 2. Okay. So somebody please explain to me. And also everything he had to do, the lives he had to he lost his best friend.
Yeah.
Mariko sacrificed herself. Honestly, maybe Toranaga's the real villain here because if he did all of that just for the good of his country, then what the fuck? You're a psychopath. There was so much personal loss.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like it was always headed to this point. I can't say, wholeheartedly, he had no interest in ever becoming a shogun. No, he's a wall facer. Okay. That's all I heard. The moment I learned about the term wall facer, I'm like, that's Toranaga. Okay. He's telling you what you want to hear, but at the end of the day, I don't think you can do that much strategic maneuvering without at least some personal interest in and if I do this, then I end up here politically and power wise.
I think that's a very, you can make good arguments both ways. And I think Toranaga says it himself whenever, how does it feel to shape the wind to your will? And Toranaga's like, I'll only study it. And I think that's.
Not right there. That's not an evil thing, but honestly,
I don't control it. I only study it. Yeah. So
he knows that he can only do so much, but that doesn't mean he doesn't enjoy the power he wields. No.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, you could interpret it either way. I mean, I think he, maybe at the beginning, his end goal was to do it for the best of the country. But like you said, I mean, you don't do all that. And he didn't waste Hiramoto's death because he does maneuver things and put things, studies the situation to the place where things do have one big final conflict. And then, Japan does enter into 200 plus years of peace. It's. It could be mixed motivations here, for sure.
Yeah. I also think that's fine. But to say one or the other, an absolute, no way in hell.
Yeah, I agree. No,
there was a huge amount of personal interest. It wasn't just that. And I think there was too many seeds that there were things brewing way before this show started.
Yeah.
Toranaga's been around for a while. So,
yeah.
We awesome. Just watched the final chapter in a sense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that concludes Shogun, which we will probably talk about again, as it's probably going to end up on Will's best of list at the end of this year.
You're damn right it will.
It will. And that leads us to start our journey with Fallout Season 1, Episode 1, The End. A humble recruit from a post-apocalyptic organization is tasked with scouting the wasteland in search of pre-war technology to preserve it, facing challenges and critiques along the way. We watched both episodes 1 and 2. Okay. I know we do this thing where we break down the episodes. I am so on the fence about this show. I just have to start. Like, I am on the fence to the point where I don't know how many times I picked up my phone while watching this thing. I got bored. Very bored. And I did not care for these two episodes. Yeah, and I am going to watch the next two episodes, but I don't know. I don't know if this show is for me.
Yeah. So I like them. I like Shogun, where like for you, where Shogun I think about like after I watched the episode and da da da. This one I watched it and I moved on. I mean, not in a bad way. It's just like what I did like about it. Because I know there were, you know, whenever I first saw the trailer, I guess earlier this year, maybe late last year, whenever it was, the inevitable comparisons to The Last of Us, you know, came about. And we talked about it too, you know, with video game shows and that kind of stuff. But as I was watching it, I got some of The Boys vibes from it, to be honest. And that's where I'm feeling like I want to give it a chance. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like there is a lot of satire in the show.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that satire, you know, in particular, just picking on, you know, picking on the elements of the American dream, sort of like, and the satire of it, and sort of the world that they built in this show, you know, and it's not and from what I gather, just hearing people talk about it, it's not a, you know, like, unlike The Last of Us, which really adapted the game that, you know, for the most part, that was there, and they just translated to live action. Here, this show is building on the previous six Fallout games, you know, in that universe, and then telling a new story that could, you know, conceptually be, you know, the seventh video game, but instead they're just doing it live action with the Vault 33 dwellers. So that said, I think those are some of the my overall initial thoughts as far as some of the vibes I got from the show. And I'm like, okay, color me intrigued that I want to come back before making a final judgment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in this episode, we meet Lucy McLean, who's one of the vault dwellers. And there is a trade with another vault. The trade goes south because they do get married, but they on the wedding night, they also realize that they traded that vault had previously been raided, and so these are raiders. Who are actually not only raiding their vault, but were after Lucy's father.
Mm-hmm.
And they are led by, I'm trying to find her name, Modaver? Yeah, Modaver.
Modaver, yeah.
Yeah. Who clearly knows something about the McLeans as she leaves after taking Lucy's father. She mentions how much Lucy looks like her mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she also has a line. There's an exchange between her and Lucy's father where Modaver says, "Everyone knows who I am. Do they know who they are?" Emphasis on they. Mm-hmm. And they're the result of life's tricky little choices. And so I think that I like that line because that does allow for some intrigue of like, okay, so there's obviously something going on there. Mm-hmm. There's history. Clearly we're kind of interrupting a story and being told bits of information. So I like that. And I'm curious about it. And I have some thoughts, especially after episode two, but yeah. What did you think about this whole trade, raid, and then hostage exchange?
So this whole, like, the whole vault concept. So, you know, of course, we get with the way the series starts, you know, we start 200 years in the past from present day when we meet the vault dwellers. So it was like right before, you know, and you know, so we get this like post, it's like America that like on a divergent timeline that never really grew out of the 50s, even though it was like, I guess the timeline for this show is like actually it's in the near future, like maybe 2070s or something like that, as far as when we first, you know, see the cowboy and his little daughter and stuff at the birthday party. And then, of course, all the bombs start dropping, which I bring that up in that when we fast, you know, to really get to the vaults themselves. And then, like you said, when we were first introduced to the vaults, we just sort of see these communities, very egalitarian in some regards, as far as it seems like the structure. And then also, very weird, like dynamic too, because you're like, you got like these breeders and stuff. So I'm like, is this like some kind of eugenics thing?
Right.
You know, you know, especially given that the goals are to like, when the radiation levels are low enough, they'll repopulate the surface. So there's, but then we see other things happening in this show where it's just like, wait a minute, there's these other settlements and stuff clearly that are above ground. So, you know, to your point about that line, it seems that something was going on with Lucy's father and Wardover and all these other factions and people in this world, that, you know, there is a history there. And I guess as the season progresses, we will learn more about that history and really just sort of seeing how this whole post-apocalyptic society like developed, and, you know, how humanity was like managed over these few years. And you got these vault dwellers who you know, have a pretty good life, you know, they got the, it seems, when compared to some of the other, you know, compared to the brotherhood that we saw with Maximus, you know, is the next character we're introduced to. And then, of course, you know, we see what eventually happened to the cowboy, becoming a ghoul. So, that's just sort of my sort of thoughts there with what's going on with that line in particular, and just the vaults themselves.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the next character we are introduced to is Maximus, who's on the surface. And we're kind of introduced to our first surface society through Maximus. And they're, I don't really know what they're. They're the quote unquote police, but they also are a cult.
Yeah, and you can say the vault's a cult too.
Yeah, they're. I don't know if they're the police or if they're just also more well-intentioned raiders. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I wasn't clear about what they were either. I mean, they seem to be some type of protectors. Protectors of what? I don't know. And then, you know, and we get some further, you know, second episode. I know we're trying to keep them, you know, take an episode at a time, but. They do seem interrelated in some regards.
Oh yeah, they definitely are. And I think that's one of my issues with, these first two episodes is this first episode, because of how you're first introduced to Lucy, you follow her story. And the next thing you know, it's like, oh, now we're going to switch to Maximus. And then by the end, we get the brief 5 minutes of the ghoul. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, okay, this is our Scooby game. Next episode, Scooby gang comes together.
Yeah.
A lot of exposition, a lot of setup, and a lot of me just being like, okay, I'm waiting for the story to be.
Yeah. So
and I get it, it's beginning.
Yeah.
But this is just not the way I prefer series beginnings to occur. I totally understand what they're doing. It's not lost on me. it's just not my preference of how to start a story.
Yeah. I will say the first episode was hard for me to get through.
Yeah.
I mean, because I was like, all right, first episode, all pilots are always tough. It had enough, like I said earlier, it had enough there. It got me intrigued that I was like, okay, not how, you know, for a post-apocalyptic show, it's like, okay, I'm seeing where everything's set up. The vault piece was interesting to me. Where it lost me was actually Maximus.
I know, right? I completely agree with you. Where I was on board with the vault.
Yeah.
And then I kind of raised an eyebrow with a stupidly extended, long wannabe James Gunn action. Play a country song during it. I'm like, I've now seen this. I understand it's a very popular artistic choice right now, but enough is enough. Come on. This isn't anything original. I'm just going to call it spade a spade.
Yeah.
But then we get to Maximus, and oh my God, Maximus, can we kill him? Because he, so far in the episode and a half that he appears in, he is so boring. He is so boring. And I just don't like him. There's nothing. And you know, Lucy's a bit annoying. Mm-hmm. But I have a similar feeling about her that I did as I did with Luffy at the beginning of One Piece, where I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I can handle too much Luffy. But then you meet Maximus and you're like, oh, it can get worse.
And that's the hard thing too. Is like, if you're introducing characters and you're trying, you know, it would have been better almost, not that I'm like a showrunner or whatever, but I almost feel like, honestly, have Lucy's story from episodes 1 and 2 play out, and then in episode 2 introduce Maximus or something. I don't know. It's just something just structurally, it just did not resonate with me. And I was just like, checked out until, you know, I actually liked the Dane character better when in that sequence. And I wasn't really I was there, but not with it until, you know, she ended up getting just injured because of the razors they put in her boot, and then when they're interrogating Maximus, and the one thing that did stick out, and all of the whole sequence that sticks out with me with him is he, whenever questioned by his superiors, he kind of like, no, I didn't do it, but you know, I kind of wish it did.
I think that the best part of that was the interrogation scene.
Yeah,
that was a really good part. But I agree with you. You could have allowed us to be in the vault for the full episode and maybe have a little bit of her on surface ground. Mm-hmm. And then in the next episode, or maybe just like what you do with the ghoul at the end of the episode where we knew Walter Goggins wasn't going to go anywhere. That's why when they first said 200 years later, I'm like, okay, the math ain't mathing for me right now. I know. But then when they kind of explain how the radiation and he's become this other thing and how that's all working, and they dig him up and to send him on this mission, like, I think we just needed that. We needed like a 10-minute, this is Maximus, this is a brotherhood, and then you're going to learn more later. Because having this dual story between Lucy in the vault and Maximus in the brotherhood, it didn't mix well. And it just, it wasn't that interesting. The next episode, though, when you start to actually mix the pot up and the people actually start, just my one problem with this is, man, the convenience of how these people all end up in Philly. And it does, is it just with Lucy, Maximus, and the ghoul? No. We have to add in Willix, who is the target in the second episode, the target that Maximus and Lord Titan are sent by the Brotherhood to retrieve, as in the opening sequence of the target episode, we are shown that Willix is a Wilzig. Sorry, mm-hmm. I keep saying Willix. Wilzig is a mad scientist of sorts, mm-hmm. But he likes a dog. So we're, more importantly, and I hope the dog is around for a while. CX-404. And we see them escape the lab with something, and they're off to Philly, and that's where conveniently everyone ends up.
Yep. Yeah. So I will give them, you know, I guess it's 8 episodes, so I will give them credit for not dragging it out.
I thank the Lord.
Plot convenience for sure, but thank you for not dragging it out.
I know. And then so because I've already started on this episode, I just want to go to the very end. What did you think when Wilzig killed himself?
Michael Emerson, not there long enough.
I know. I didn't really like I don't know. He's definitely an actor who, when you see him, you're like, oh, I know the character you're playing right now.
Yeah. I want more Wilzig. I mean, I was like, damn it. The one thing that like got me intrigued about this show is gone.
I know it. And every time like we were getting, Lucy was getting a lot of heat from everyone she encountered on surface. I mean, she's clearly a vault dweller. Yeah. They were all center. Wilzig was the one person who did it in a way, but also wasn't as patronizing to her.
Yeah, exactly.
To an extent, you almost felt Wilzig should have been in a vault.
Yep. Maybe he was. Maybe because he knew a lot. He's like, I know who you are, Lucy. Yeah. And, you know, and so he clearly, you know, to what we were discussing earlier, there's a history here with all these characters.
Okay. I have my, thank you for bringing up that line. I was going to forget it. Here's my theory and what I'm going to put out there. And I know 200 years have passed, but I do remember in the opening sequence of the first episode, while they're on TV, while they show a brief clip of TV and they mention something about the president's family has gone into hiding.
Mm-hmm.
I think the McLanes are part of that family.
I think you're spot on with that theory.
And you know what? I'm gonna make another callback to Three Body Problem. I think they figured out how to freeze themselves.
They froze themselves, or like you said, I mean, this enough of these, because I mean there is. And that's what I do like about this show is, and they do show with Lucy and meeting the people in Philly, they are really getting into some of the class issues and structures and stuff. So to your point, you know, whenever the Great War happened, you know, there was a class of people like, and I think you're right. I mean, I think that is probably why Vault 33 is special compared to say Vault 32 and some of the other ones. Not knowing anything about the lore of the game, fair enough. You know, I will freely admit that. But I don't think
Vault 33 is special.
Well, it seemed, you know, when I say special, just meaning like it just seemed to be suburbia.
Yeah. No, it definitely did.
And it's on full display when Lucy's out, you know, interacting with people, you know, and to your, you know, and Wilzig definitely, you know, he wasn't patronizing for sure and saying, look, you know, I'm trying to help you out here, kid. You're clearly not from around here. You're lighting a fire in the middle of the night in the wastelands.
Yeah.
And then of course her interactions with Ma Jang and Philly. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I just hope that she and the ghoul have some conversation. Oh, my other prediction.
Yeah.
Movir. Mm. That could be the cowboy's daughter.
Okay. Mm. Mm.
Just saying.
Well, you know.
I don't know.
It could be. That's another, you know.
You know, since all these characters are suddenly conveniently meeting, I think that we've been introduced to a bunch of characters that are all going to conveniently be connected.
Yeah.
And so, oh, what did you think about Michael Rappaport being Lord Titanitis?
I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I was like, I know him from somewhere. And I think that was spot on casting.
Oh my God. The only reason why I couldn't, like, I've seen his work. I know he's in some classic movies, of course.
Yeah.
But really why he's on my radar right now is because I didn't realize this, but he's a huge fan of Vanderpump Rules and reality television on Bravo. Huge fan. So he like he does TikToks about it, all of the stuff. The moment they took off, I was just like, this makes sense. This makes sense. I just need him to say the word Scandoval and then we have it a day. Like, my God. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the fight between the ghoul and Maximus that I probably spent most of my time like walking around doing other things during, because it went on way too long?
That was another, it was just funny, you know, it was just cartoony, that whole sequence. I mean, I guess they got to do a better job of getting me on board with Maximus, because at this point, I'm just not there with him. I mean, if he's supposed to be like, I don't know what his role in all of this is. I mean, clearly Lucy's the, you know, she's got her mission. The ghoul is, you know, clearly what he is. Maximus, I mean, he may be he gets the short shrift of storytelling here, because he just seems to be, well, he's consistent in one way. I mean, he's cold-blooded. I mean, he, you know, like with whenever Dane got her foot cut and he was cut off, and he was just like, I wish I didn't do it, but I wish I did. And then how he treated Titus whenever, you know, he didn't give him the stimulant to help him get healed. I mean, he, you know, he's definitely got a cold-blooded streak in him. And I know they did flash back to like how these, you know, the armor warriors rescued him from wherever he was when he was a little boy. So I'm wondering if he's just like, he's reached this place, and we did see elements of this in the episode, both episodes, where he may be disillusioned, this organized with the Brotherhood. And so,
I mean, to understand more about Maximus, we have to understand the Brotherhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they did some teases of flashbacks of how he became a part of the Brotherhood, but we still don't really understand what the Brotherhood is in terms of this world. And there's a lot there.
Yeah, and I did do a little bit. I did listen to one video just to help to get some context. And I want to say the Brotherhood was like, this was just a straight backstory video I watched. And I want to say that they mentioned the Brotherhood maybe showed up in either Fallout 3 or 4. And I mean, I think they were like, I guess, the quote unquote good guys. But so clearly there may be some like elements of it who are not, not so good. So maybe that's why I was thinking maybe he might be a little disillusioned with the Brotherhood.
Right. In terms of this fight, it dawned on me about halfway through why I'm probably not digging the Maximus Brotherhood Lord Titanitis storyline. It is so video game.
Yeah.
And I know we're watching a show based on a video game, but you brought it up before, the comparison between this show and Last of Us. Last of Us, you would get, I don't really think there were a time when you could say, oh, we were clearly watching a game based on a video game. Mm-hmm. I mean, the suit of Lord Tinnitus itself is just so video game, where you're just like, oh, and also bad CGI. It's bad CGI, in my opinion. CGI. So I don't know. It felt much more like they were so focused on bringing this game. And I, from what I understand, another thing to point out is, I think my brother told me he played Fallout, and Fallout is, I forget exactly the term they use it. It's not the same type of video game that the Last of Us is, because Last of Us is a story, like, and then there's gameplay in, like, there's gameplay and then there's these stories and these cutscenes. While I think it's called an open player game, where it's like, here's the world and now here's the game and maybe a little bit of story, especially because there are sequels, so you connect, but not, it's not that much focused on an overarching story itself. And so I think I'm starting to feel that, where they did bring a world to life, and we have some different perspectives on the world with the characters. But I'm just hoping we get our Scooby Gang moment where they can all work together, because the ghoul needs Lucy and the Lucy needs the ghoul right now, because we really need somebody to like whip her into shape. And Maximus, we just need answers.
Yeah.
We need to understand, or else you gotta go. Give the suit to someone else. Or you know what? Let's just get rid of the suit altogether, because it's not that good CGI.
And to your thing, I know you mentioned earlier about the dog, CX 404. It looks like CX is gonna be around, because the ghoul did treat him from the wound that he inflicted on him, whatever.
I hope CX and the ghoul, like,
it looks like they're going to be the partner. The dog seems to be thankful to the ghoul for rescuing him, because at the end of the episode they were together.
And then they're all after, they're all off to see Madora. We got to learn how to pronounce that name.
Moldaver, I think. I gotta watch it again. I've only watched episodes one time, so I gotta get the pronunciations down.
Moldaver. All right. Well, on that note, Will, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter, also known as X, at Will M. Polk, WILLMPOLK.
And you can find me there too at SJ Belmont, SJBELMONT. Please follow our crew on Twitter at Scene and Nerd. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and Threads at Scene_N_Nerd. And our website, www.sceneandnerdpodcast.com. But most importantly, rate, follow, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Good night, geek out. You're welcome.